Well, okay, our gospel lesson is from the second chapter of Matthew. We know the beginning part of the second chapter, that is the story about the visit of the Magi, and we have the star, and we have Herod. It is a story about the acceptance of Jesus by Gentiles, by non-Jews. Now we end that story, and we go to the second part of the chapter, where we have a story about the rejection, about the persecution, about the hostility to Jesus. This is by Herod, by the scribes, by the religious authorities, so on and so forth. So now we hear what the Spirit is saying to the church, beginning in the second half, after the Magi. The Magi is next Sunday, that's for the Epiphany. Now after the Magi left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up and take the child and mother, flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." So Joseph, in absolute obedience to the divine command, got up, took the child and his mother by night, and they fled to Egypt. And they remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet Hosea, that out of Egypt, the land of the Exodus, I have called my son. When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he was infuriated, so he sent and he killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that Herod had learned from the Magi. This was then to fulfill what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah, that a voice was heard in Ramah, the grieving and mourning place of the exile, the wailing and the loud lamentation about Rachel weeping for her children. Then when Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel." The only expression of this in the New Testament where we have that phrase, "For those who were seeking the child's life are dead." The Gospel of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Now, we should always start the new year with something very, very positive, right? It's not a very positive text week. There's a kindergarten class out in California, about 67 miles north of San Francisco. They have set up a hotline. It's called Pep Talk. Like the TikTok, it's Pep Talk. And so I have a phone number for you to call. So you have to get your pencil out or pen, or for those who are high tech, you get your little machine out there to put it in there. And then you just pray to God that those little machines, the Russians or the Chinese, don't blow out the satellite, because if the satellite goes out and you don't have paper or pencil, you're going to be out of luck. All right, so we'll give you the phone number here. What am I giving you the phone number for? Well, this is a class. The teachers were inspired, these kindergartners, because they have come through the pandemic with all of its trials and tribulations. They've had the California wildfires. They got changes in the family, so on and so forth. And the kids are still kind of positive and hopeful. So they created this little pep talk. Okay, so you dial this number, and what happens is you get a menu, of course. If you're feeling mad, frustrated, or nervous, press 1, and then you get a positive message. I tried out all the messages to see what happened here. If you need words of encouragement and some life advice, that was the first number I pressed. Number 2. If you need a pep talk from kindergartners, you press 3. If you need to just hear kids laughing with delight, press a 4. And then Espanol, press 5, cinco. The number, all right. After the benediction, not during worship, right? Okay. It's always dangerous. You give out papers to students, and then they start reading them, and nobody listens anymore. All right, 707, it's 7078 pep talk, but you probably like to get numbers on that. 707, which is the area code, 873 707-873-7862. 707-873-7862. So I have mine on paper so that I am protected from the satellites being blown out. Okay. Now this is after benediction here. It really is delightful. And if you want to get playful, you can do all of 1, 2, 3, 4, but I need the light advice, so I did number 2 first. All right, now we get to our text for the day, which is of a different stripe. So the good news is good news, yes, to some, but it's bad news to some, and the good news is just irrelevant news to many others, until it's needed for convenience or for crisis. Then all of a sudden it's needy news. So we all know that when you read a New Testament text, especially a gospel text, more so than the others, you got to know the Hebrew scriptures. You got to know the Old Testament, or you're really not going to get the whole gospel text. So this is an easy one, because we probably know a good deal of what's behind this text. So we know the birth story, but this is Matthew's story. This is not Luke. So we don't have any imaginary innkeeper or inn. They're not existent anyway in Luke, but we don't have any of that business, okay? There's no shepherds and all that stuff, angels. This is Matthew's story, so we're just going to go to Bethlehem, and we got a house and all that business. All right. And Joseph is the star, not Mary. But if you go back and you look at the stories of Exodus, does this sound familiar? So Pharaoh receives a warning from powers that be that there is a baby about to be born who's going to be a rival, a challenger to his rule. So therefore, it sets in motion, if you've got a challenger, you've got to rub them out. So he is going to kill all the Hebrew infants 2 years and younger, right? That sounds familiar. Meanwhile, there is a dream to Jochebed. This is a man whose wife, or excuse me, Amram, whose wife Jochebed is pregnant, and that's going to be the child Moses, that their child is the one who is born to kind of quote-unquote save Israel, and therefore it must be protected, it must be preserved. And we know how that story goes, okay, about placing the baby in the bulrushes and so on and so forth, right? So now Matthew is written to Gentiles and Jews, but there's a lot of Jews in this congregation. So if you're a Jew, you know your Hebrew scriptures, and you know that the storyline has to continue. You can't just start something brand new. You would like these Jews to become Jewish Christians. So the storyline has to continue, and we saw that in all of Advent. We saw the genealogy. The genealogy from Abraham to Jesus is the genealogy that you know as a Jew, even though it went through the four women and whatnot. So, as a Jew, you're hearing the story and you're resonating, yes, this makes sense, this makes sense. I've kind of heard this story before, but this is going to be the new form because I'm now going to believe that the promises have been fulfilled and that this is the Messiah because he's in the genealogical line and he's in the storyline that is consistent. Okay, that's great. Now we get to the, and then we have the little citations, right? Hosea, Jeremiah, to show that it is matching the Hebrew scriptures. Now we get to the end of that, and they're down there in Egypt, right? They fled to Egypt. And then the next verse says, and then Herod died. And it's like, okay, so we're missing something. Months, years? We're missing something here. Is this like a halftime intermission and then you just imagine time passed? Or is this film that's still on the editor's floor and they forgot to get it in here into the text somehow or another? We've got a huge gap here. But what we do know in this gap is that this good news about what we call the incarnation, the birth, is good to some people, but it's bad to some people. Herod, as it was to Pharaoh in the earlier story back in Exodus, and apparently is bad news to the, in Matthew tells the story, to scribes, to Pharisees, and then he says, and all Jerusalem. So there's a whole lot of people involved here. Or it's just irrelevant news until there's a need for it of convenience or crisis. Very odd, because in the earlier part of Matthew's story, which we read next week, is star, yes? We got Herod with all sorts of things going on there. We got Magi, everybody knows the Magi story. And then we have the adoration, that with the gold, the frankincense, and the myrrh, and that has been the scene for many, 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 many very famous paintings and artistic renderings over the years, the adoration. And then we get to the escape to Egypt, and then nothing. Now what? So, okay, well, let's think about this. Let's go to Vienna, and outside the downtown, if you will, center city of Vienna, there are some palaces and there are some other major buildings. There's an art museum there. Inside that art museum in Vienna is the Bruegel Room. Bruegel the Elder and Bruegel the Younger. They're Flemish painters, so that's kind of like northern Belgium and southern Netherlands. So the Bruegel Room is there. Who are the Bruegels? Well, Peter Bruegel the Younger, for instance, has many, many, many paintings. They're from the 1500s, so it's Renaissance. Renaissance is realism. So it's not going to be abstract, and it's not going to be imaginative. This is kind of like we're painting photographs of how life is. And what the Bruegels especially like to do is just paint scenes of life, peasant life, people doing things. It would be like someone wandering around with a camera and just taking snapshots. This is what life looks like in downtown Apollo. This is what life looks like out in Spring Church. This is what life looks like out at Fox's here in 56. Just life as it is. So the one painting you can go in to see, which is a big piece, the Adoration, by the Magi. Well, we know the story because it's the Renaissance, the 1500s. A lot of their stories have biblical imagery along with the peasant life. Except their biblical stories, they being from northern Belgium and southern Netherlands, they being Flemish, they place all these Bible stories into Flanders. So you have the Adoration of the Magi, and there is the Christ child, snow and all. It just looks like northern Belgium, and it looks like a peasant village in northern Belgium because that's what they know. Except that what's front and center in this painting is a big tree. Oh, it's a cross-shaped tree. So we have the birth with the adoration, and we have the big cross-shaped. That's what catches your attention, the cross-shaped tree. Well, they know very well, yeah, birth and death, they're inextricably connected. The incarnation and the crucifixion, they go together. They're two sides of the same coin. Christmas Day and Good Friday are part and parcel of each other. You can't have one without the other. And so as Luther always said, when you celebrate Christmas Day, you should also celebrate Good Friday. And then Good Friday, you should also celebrate Christmas Day. Now, what's going on in this painting? Well, probably the same as if they were to do a painting today of Christ's return, and what would people be doing? Well, it's a typical Bruegel painting. People are busy. They are busy, busy, busy. They're doing all sorts of things. They are fetching water. They are chopping some wood for some fuel. They are milling about. They are shopping. They are preparing food. Yeah, they're doing things to take care of themselves. They're doing things that they need to do on daily kind of living tasks, right? There are also a bunch of people who are near the campfire trying to keep warm, because this is going to be northern Belgium. There's more people there than there are over in the corner here where there is there's a couple of unlikely saints who are adoring the Christ child with the little halo. You see, the good news is, it's bad news to some, But to a lot of people, it's just irrelevant news until there's a time that it's needed for convenience or for crisis. That's where these texts go. Let's shift into the 20th century. W.H. Auden's grand opus, for the time being, a Christmas oratorio. Very, very long work. Also, there are musical compositions for this, which are spectacular. It ends, okay, this was written in the 1940s, and very much Auden's work is a literary version of Bruegel's paintings. So this is life as it is. This is who people are. This is who we are. So the end has the narrator, and you really have to kind of read the whole thing to see where it all goes. But for the time being, a Christmas oratorio, and so we've celebrated the whole thing, and so now, where are we? Well, as in previous years, says the narrator, we have seen the actual vision. We have seen it. We have beheld it. And we fail to do more than to simply entertain it as an agreeable possibility. We have sent him away. The Christmas feast is already fading. And already the mind begins to be vaguely aware of an unpleasant whiff of the apprehension of the thought of Lent and Good Friday, which cannot, after all, now be very far off. But, okay, for the time being, we're all here, and we have bills to be paid, we have machines to keep and repair, we have irregular verbs to learn, and for the time being, we need to redeem overcome its insignificance. To those who have seen the child, however dimly, however miraculously, the time being is, in a sense, the most trying time of all. Well, yeah, because there are ribbons and bows and gift wrappings, there's tinsel, there's decorations, and pretty much they're already all bagged for the trash collection. Or they're lying next to a dried-out tree out by the street. We have seen the actual vision, but we failed to do more than entertain it as an agreeable possibility, and we've sent them away. The good news is just irrelevant news to so many people, unless it's needed for convenience or because it's a crisis. But for those who have seen, the good news is that mysteriously, miraculously, absurdly, ridiculously, the God whom we know to be the Creator has come amongst us in flesh and blood in the life of one who walked on the face of the earth, as do we, to heal this broken world and to save us from ourselves, from our self-centeredness, from our sin. To some, that is good news. To some, that is threatening news. And to many, it's just irrelevant news, unless it's convenience or crisis that's intruded on our lives. So we wind up with a choice. We tell the story, we celebrate the incarnation, we now either embrace or repel, we grow into the incarnation or we reject, as we know in the stories, particularly from Matthew or predated in the stories of Moses. It's either a time to see that the eighth day of creation has arrived with all of its possibilities for new life, for new possibilities of joy and peace and harmony, and for the world to look more what God intended it to be. Luther wrote that even if he marshaled all his inner resources and strengths, he could not embrace the incarnation. It would take an act of God. It would take the work of the Spirit. Because if we had the inner resources to embrace the mystery of the incarnation, then we wouldn't need a Savior. And we can just do it on our own. But we need the power of the Spirit to support us, to strengthen us, that we might behold this incredible vision, this life, this incarnation. There are unlikely saints who periodically and in various places, they take time out from the busyness of life to adore the Christ child. Gentle Mary laid her child lowly on a manger. There he lay, the undefiled, but to the world, a stranger. Such a babe, such a place. Can it be that he is the Savior? Ask those who've been saved of all the race, for they know about his favor. In the name of Christ.